to set up a test, and then about 3 hours for the automated test to run, during which time I would just be sitting around and waiting for the test to finish. So I could only run 2 or 3 tests a day at the most. I also realized that nobody was tracking what time I came in or left the office. In fact, I don't think anyone really even knew who I was. For the first month or so, I felt incredibly lucky. I couldn't believe that I was getting paid good money to do something that took almost no effort. Sanji and I had found an apartment that was 7 minutes away from the office, and we were roommates once again. Within a week, I had my daily routine down. 10 a.m., show up at my desk. 10.05 a.m., start running one of the tests. 10.10 a.m., check my email, send emails to friends from my training class. 11.30 a.m., go home for lunch. 12.30 p.m., take a nap. 1.45 p.m., head back to the office. 2 p.m., start running another one of those tests. 2.05 p.m., check my email, respond to emails from friends in my training class. 4 p.m., head back home. I felt that I had lucked out because I had such an easy schedule, whereas Sanjay usually wouldn't get home until 7 p.m. I would occasionally ask him how his job was, and he'd shrug and say something like, "It's okay, not that exciting." I told him that my job was really not that exciting either, but maybe we could work on something during the evenings and weekends together for fun to help combat the boredom. There was that thing called the World Wide Web that was starting to become more and more popular. Sanjay was really good at graphic design, so maybe we could start something on the side where we could create websites for other companies. The idea of starting our own side business sounded pretty fun. We decided to name the company Internet Marketing Solutions, or IMS for short. We created our own website, ordered a second phone line for our apartment, and went to Kinko's to print out some customized business cards. We were ready to start signing up some customers. We had a plan for how to sign up customers. First, we would approach the local Chamber of Commerce and offer to build their website for free. Then, we could tell all the local businesses that the Chamber was a customer of ours, avoiding any mention that they were not paying us, sign up as many local businesses as possible, and the money would start rolling in soon after. So, first things first, we had to get the Chamber of Commerce to let us build their website. Even though our pitch to them involved no money, approaching them was my first cold call over the phone, which led to my first in-person sales call. I had set up a meeting with them for 12:30 p.m., which would fit in perfectly with my daily Oracle routine. On the day of my appointment, I was nervous. I had never made a successful sales call before, but I knew my mission was to convince them that they needed a website and that we were the right partners for them. I knew that appearances were important, so when I left Oracle to go on my lunch break at 11:30 a.m., I went home first and put on the suit and tie I had worn for graduation a few months earlier. I made sure that I had plenty of business cards, and I brought a few of our brochures that Sanjay had created and printed up a couple days earlier. Although I was nervous, the meeting went well. They were particularly receptive to the fact that we were offering to do everything for free. Over the next few weeks, my lunch breaks got longer and longer, and I ended up spending most of my time during the day meeting with the Chamber to make sure they were happy with what we were creating for them. Sanjay's nights got longer and longer, as he was the one staying up all night actually creating their website. I was the sales and customer support guy, and he was the product and design guy. We made a good team. We launched the Chamber of Commerce's website within a month, and now we were ready to start getting paying customers. Our first target was the Hillsdale Mall, which was the big mall down the street from where we lived. We thought that would make a good choice because if we were able to sign them up as a customer, then we would be able to approach each of the stores inside and tell them that the mall itself had signed up with us, so they should as well. Over the next couple of months, I spent less and less time in the office at Oracle, as I met with the Hillsdale Mall and other small businesses. We eventually convinced the mall to pay us $2,000 to design, manage, and host their entire website. We had done it. We had our first real paying customer. We could quit our unfulfilling and boring day jobs at Oracle so we could run our own business full time. And so we decided that's what we were going to do. I was a nervous wreck the morning that I was going to tell my boss at Oracle that I was quitting. After procrastinating for half an hour, I eventually worked up the courage to walk down the hallway to his office. I was ready to give him the news. Through his office window, he saw me approach and looked up. We made eye contact. I could feel my heart beating faster and faster. and then he looked away. I glanced over and realized at the last minute that he was meeting with someone else in his office, so I couldn't tell him right then. I felt a huge sense of relief and continued walking past his office, pretending that I was actually just on my way to the bathroom down the hall. So I washed my hands and waited inside the bathroom for another couple of minutes to make it seem like I had actually gone to the bathroom. And then I walked past my boss's office, back to my desk, and spent the next half hour emailing my friends. I figured that 30 minutes should be enough time for the meeting he was in to be over, but then I decided to wait another 15 minutes after that, just to be sure, and then started walking towards his office again. For some reason, I was even more nervous the second time. I think it's because I wasn't sure if he was still going to be meeting with whoever he was meeting with earlier. If he was still in that meeting, then I'd have to pretend I was making yet another trip to the bathroom, and he'd probably start thinking that I was maybe having some serious bladder or stomach issues. He was probably also thinking already that it was weird that I was using the bathroom close to his office instead of the one near my cubicle. But maybe he thought the one near me was out of order or something. I was pretty sure that all of these thoughts were running through his mind, so I was trying to convince myself that it really didn't matter. It was going to be my last day anyway. But in the back of my head, I kept thinking all he would remember 10 years later would be me needing to use the bathroom multiple times within a short period of time on the wrong side of the building. That would be disastrous. So I resolved to make sure that his last memory of me was not that weird guy who needed to go to the bathroom a lot. I had a plan. I would walk straight into his office and get this over with. So I marched over, telling myself that there was no turning back now. To make sure we didn't accidentally have any awkward eye contact beforehand, this time I walked closer to the wall so he couldn't see me approach from far away. My heart racing, I saw that his door was open this time, and when I was finally in front of his door, I looked in, ready to tell him I was resigning. Except there was nobody there. This was going to go down in history as the most difficult resignation ever. I guess he had gone to another meeting or to lunch, so I decided to go to lunch as well. I would come back in the afternoon for resignation attempt number 3. So I let out a sigh and turned around, and ran right into my boss, who was behind me. "Tony, were you looking for me?" he asked. I wasn't mentally prepared for this scenario. I'd been thinking about the value meal I was going to order from Taco Bell. Surprised and flustered, I hurriedly mumbled an awkward, "No, sorry," and walked away as fast as I could without arousing any more suspicion. At Taco Bell, I made 2 very important decisions. I decided to try their double-decker taco value meal, which turned out to have a surprisingly calming effect on my stomach. I also decided that I would wait until tomorrow to resign. Clearly, I was being given signs that today was not the right day. When I got back to the office later that afternoon, I was a lot more relaxed knowing that I didn't have to deal with resigning that day. I headed to the bathroom that was near my cubicle, only to be greeted with a sign on the door that said it was being cleaned and to please use the other bathroom, the one next to my boss's office. Luckily for me, I was now quite familiar with the location of that bathroom, so I headed there. As I approached the bathroom, I saw that my boss was alone in his office with the door open. I impulsively decided I just wanted to get this over with, so before I could think too much about it, I forced myself to walk into his office. "Do you have a few minutes?" I asked. I closed the door and sat down across from him. This was now the point of no return. "I've decided to resign," I said nervously. I'd only been at Oracle for 5 months, and I hadn't really accomplished anything there. I didn't know how my boss would take the news. I was worried that he might be upset that I hadn't been at Oracle for very long and was already leaving. Or maybe he knew I had been taking long lunch breaks and was secretly happy that I was leaving. Or maybe he didn't care. The 3 seconds for him to respond seemed like 3 minutes. "Wow, you must be joining another startup. What an exciting opportunity." He seemed genuinely excited and happy for me. He thought I was joining a company that had millions of dollars in venture capital funding. I didn't have the heart to tell him that I was just bored at Oracle and wanted to take time to make more sales calls for the web design business that Sanjay and I were doing out of our living room. At the rate we were going, we would actually be making a lot less money than we were at Oracle. But we wanted to run our own business and be in control of our own destiny. This wasn't about the money. It was about not being bored. Both Sanjay and I had now officially resigned, and we were ready to begin the next chapter of our lives. We had no idea where it would lead us. But wherever it was, we knew it had to be better than feeling bored and unfulfilled. We were ready for an adventure. Startup. As it turned out, the adventure we were waiting for to happen to us didn't end up happening on its own. We ended up sitting around in our apartment, occasionally doing some web design work, and going out every once in a while to try to drum up some more sales. By the end of the first week, it dawned on me that neither of us was actually passionate about doing web design work. We loved the idea of owning and running our own business, but the reality ended up being a lot less fun than the fantasy. My parents were not exactly thrilled that I'd quit my job at Oracle without a real plan for what to do next. When I told my dad that Sanjay and I were planning on running a web design business, he told me that it didn't really sound like that could ever become a big enough business to be meaningful. And now, 1 week into it, both Sanjay and I were starting to wonder if we'd made the right decision to leave Oracle. The next few weeks were tough and somewhat depressing. We started to spend most of our time just surfing the web to combat the boredom and to keep ourselves entertained. Watching Sanjay go into the coat closet to nap there in the middle of the day was only sort of funny the first time. We were starting to get a bit stir-crazy. Luckily, we both had enough savings from the jobs we had in college that we didn't need to worry about whether we would be able to pay the rent for the rest of the year. We didn't know what we wanted to do, but we had learned what we didn't want to do. We didn't want to work for Oracle. We didn't want to do any more web design work. We didn't want to make any more sales calls. And we didn't want to be bored out of our minds. So we spent our days and nights trying to figure out the next great internet business idea, but we really couldn't come up with anything that sounded good. One weekend, out of sheer boredom, we decided to do some computer programming to test out an idea for something we initially called the Internet Link Exchange, or ILE, which we eventually renamed to just Link Exchange. The idea behind Link Exchange was pretty simple. If you ran a website, then you could sign up for our service for free. Upon signing up, you would insert some special code into your web pages, which would cause banner ads to start showing up on your website automatically. Every time a visitor came to your website and saw one of the banner ads, you would earn half a credit. So, if you had 1,000 visitors come to your website every day, you would end up earning 500 credits per day. With those 500 credits, your website would be advertised 500 times across the Link Exchange network for free. So this was a great way for websites that didn't have advertising budgets to gain additional exposure for free. The extra 500 advertising impressions left over would be for us to keep. The idea was that we would grow the Link Exchange network over time and eventually have enough advertising inventory to hopefully sell to large corporations. Sanjay and I finished all of the computer programming for our experiment over a weekend, and then we sent emails to 50 of our favorite small websites that we had found while surfing, asking them if they'd like to help us test out our new service. To our surprise, more than half the websites we emailed signed up to help us test out the service within 24 hours. As people visited their websites and saw the banner ads, word started to spread about Link Exchange. Within a week, we knew that our project that was initially meant to fight boredom had the potential to turn into something big. We decided that we should focus all of our energy on making Link Exchange a successful business. The next 5 months were a bit of a whirlwind. Every day, more and more websites were signing up for our service. We weren't really worried about trying to make money yet. We were just focused on growing the size of the Link Exchange network. We were excited to be creating something that was growing quickly and that other people really seemed to appreciate using. Sanjay and I were working around the clock, spending half our time doing computer programming and the other half answering customer service emails. We were religious about trying to answer every email that came in as quickly as possible. Usually, we were able to answer them within 10 minutes, and people were amazed by our responsiveness. We got to the point where we couldn't keep up with doing all the email ourselves, so a friend who was visiting from out of town decided to help out and ended up never leaving. It was an exciting, fun, magical, and surreal time for all of us. We knew we were onto something big, we just had no idea how it would turn out. All the days started blurring together. We literally had no idea what day of the week it was. One day, in August 1996, we received a phone call from a guy named Lenny. He was calling from New York, and he said he wanted to buy advertising on our network and also explore the possibility of us selling the company to him. Sanjay and I agreed to meet him later that week in San Francisco for dinner. We met at Tony Roma's, a restaurant chain that specialized in all sorts of ribs. Lenny introduced himself as Bigfoot, which was apparently both the name of his company as well as his nickname. He ordered a Kahlua drink, so I got the same thing. Sanjay, however, avoided the Kahlua. He and Kahlua had not been on good terms ever since that night our college roommates forever referred to as Kahlua Night, when a few too many Kahlua drinks were consumed and later vomited back out into the toilet that we all shared as roommates. Lenny told us he wanted to make us an offer. $1 million in cash and stock for us to sell Link Exchange to Bigfoot. As part of the deal, Lenny wanted us to move to New York to work for Bigfoot. Sanjay and I looked at each other, both of us in shock. Link Exchange was only 5 months old, and we now had the opportunity to sell it for $1 million. This could be a life-changing opportunity for us. We told Lenny we wanted a few days to think about it, but the only word that I could think of in my head was, wow. Sanjay and I spent the next 24 hours talking about what we should do. We really believed that Link Exchange had the potential to be so much bigger, but it was also hard to turn down so much money. So we decided to tell Lenny that we would sell the company for $2 million cash. This way, Sanjay and I would be able to walk away with $1 million each after only 5 months of work. I had read somewhere that you're in your best negotiating position if you don't care what the outcome is, and you're not afraid to walk away. At $2 million, I would be happy whether the deal happened or not. As it turned out, Lenny didn't think we were worth $2 million, and I don't think he actually had $2 million either. So we agreed to go our separate ways, but continue to keep in touch. Link Exchange is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, Lenny said. I've made a lot of money in my lifetime, but I've also lost a lot of money when I decided to bet the farm instead of taking money off the table. I wish you the best of luck. Sanjay and I were more motivated than ever to make sure that Link Exchange would be successful. We had to prove Lenny wrong. As more and more people signed up for our service, Sanjay and I realized that we needed a lot more help, both on the customer service side of things as well as with computer programming. In addition to convincing friends who were visiting us from out of town not to go home and instead help us answer emails, we also started looking for more computer programmers. I remembered that, in college, I had been in an international computer programming competition. Each college was allowed to send a team of their best 3 computer programmers to compete against teams from the other colleges. The team I was on ended up winning first place in the competition. I decided that I should reach out to Hadi, who had been one of my teammates during one of my years on the team, to see if he would be interested in joining Link Exchange. Back in college, I learned that Hadi was interested in magic, so we had briefly discussed the idea of putting on a magic show in the college amphitheater as a way of possibly earning some extra cash. We thought we could be the next David Copperfield duo, but in the end it never went anywhere because we were both too busy. When I contacted Hadi, I asked him if he'd be interested in joining Link Exchange, and I gave him all the background information on how quickly we were growing, the $1 million offer we had just turned down, and how exciting everything was. He told me that it definitely did sound exciting, but he was busy in Seattle working at Microsoft, heading up the team that would launch a web browser called Internet Explorer to compete with the Netscape browser, so he wouldn't be able to join. However, he told me he had a twin brother who looked just like him and acted just like him. The two of them were so similar, he told me, that in college they used to go to each other's job interviews and pretend to be the other person if one of them was too busy. I wondered whether they ever pretended to be each other when going on blind dates. So, you basically want us to hire your stunt double, I asked? Yeah. Is that story about you going on job interviews for each other true? Yeah. Okay, sounds good. What's your stunt double's name? Allie. So, after one meeting with Allie at our apartment, Sanjay and I decided to make him our third partner at Link Exchange, and we opened up a real office in San Francisco. Each of us started recruiting our friends to join Link Exchange, and one by one, they did. By December of that year, there were 25 employees at Link Exchange, and most of them were friends of ours. That's when Jerry Yang, the co-founder of Yahoo, said he wanted to meet with us. Yahoo had just had a very high-profile and successful IPO earlier that year and was worth over $1 billion. Jerry was the poster child for the dot-com craziness of the time, so we were all pretty excited to get to meet an internet celebrity. We were hopeful that we'd be able to work out some sort of advertising deal with Yahoo to help accelerate our growth. As it turned out, Jerry wasn't interested in an advertising deal. He was interested in buying us, which came as a bit of a shock. We had to wait until the holidays were over because everyone in their corporate development office was on vacation, so we agreed to talk again in January. After the new year, he came and met with us in our old apartment and told Sanjay, Ali, and me the ballpark number of what they were willing to pay. $20 million. I tried my hardest not to flinch and to appear as calm as possible. The first thought that came to my mind was, wow. The second thought that came to my mind was, I'm so glad we didn't sell the company to Lenny 5 months ago. We told Jerry that we would think about it and get back to him in a few days. This whole situation felt like deja vu, except this time the numbers were bigger. Much, much bigger. The next few days were filled with a lot of angst. We had told the rest of our employees what had happened and that Sanjay, Ali, and I would be making the final decision. If we took the $20 million, I wouldn't have to work again for the rest of my life. As a thought experiment, I made a list of all the things I would do with the money if I had it. I would buy a condo or loft in San Francisco so that I'd have a place to live that I could call my own, instead of renting a place and living with a roommate. I would buy a big screen TV and build out a home theater. I would want to be able to go on mini vacations, long weekends, whenever I wanted to places like Las Vegas, New York, Miami, and LA. I would buy a new computer. I would start another company because I really enjoyed the idea of building and growing something. I was surprised that my list was so short and that it was actually pretty difficult for me to add anything else to it. With the savings I had from my previous jobs, I actually already had the ability to buy the TV and computer and go on mini vacations. I just could never bring myself to do it. I was already helping run a company that I was excited about. It seemed kind of silly to sell a company that I was excited about in order to start another company to be excited about. With the exception of actually owning my own place instead of renting, I realized that I already had the means to buy everything I wanted to buy. Lenny's words rang through my head over and over again. Link Exchange is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I knew in my heart that even if we failed, going after the opportunity was the right thing to do. It was much more important than owning a condo or loft at the age of 23. Becoming a homeowner could wait until later in life. I talked to Sanjay and Ali about my thought process, and they had independently come up with the same conclusion. We were still young. We could afford to be bold. The next day, we had a company meeting to announce our decision. As you all know, we received a term sheet from Yahoo offering to buy the company, and we've been spending the last few days thinking about whether to accept their offer or not, I began. You could feel the tension building in the room. We've decided to turn down their offer. As I looked around the room, I was surprised that there seemed to be a sense of relief in people's faces. We are living in a very special time, I said. The internet industry is exploding. Companies like Netscape, eBay, Amazon, and Yahoo are changing the course of human history. Never before have so many companies become successes in such a short period of time. We have the opportunity to be one of those companies while having the time of our lives. I'm not sure why, but for some reason I started feeling more and more emotional. My voice started shaking. I had to get my final words out and end the meeting, or else I would start crying. There will never be another 1997. It was us against the world, and we were going to make sure we would win. The next few months were a blur. Somehow, everything seemed to fall into place as if there was someone watching over us, making sure that we could do no wrong. Michael Moritz from Sequoia Capital, the same venture capital firm that funded Yahoo, became our board member and invested $3 million for a 20% stake in the company. More and more websites started signing up for our service, and we started signing up some big advertisers to bring in revenue for the company. We hired a lot of smart, passionate employees, many of whom were friends of existing employees, and we had a lot of fun together. We were on top of the world. I'm not quite sure how it started, but we had a really fun tradition at Link Exchange. Once a month, I'd send an email out to the entire company, letting them know we were having an important meeting, and that some of our important investors and board members would be attending, so everyone was required to wear a suit and tie on the day of the meeting. Everyone except for the most recently hired employees knew that it wasn't a real business meeting and that they didn't actually need to wear a suit and tie. The real reason for the meeting was so that we could initiate and haze all the new employees who had joined Link Exchange in the past month. So, once a month, all the newly hired employees would show up to the office dressed up in suits and ties. There, they would realize that they were the target of the company-wide practical joke. In the afternoon meeting, all the new hires would be called up to the front of the room to complete some sort of embarrassing task. After the Sequoia investment, we asked Michael Moritz to attend our initiation meeting, and we called him up to the front of the room along with the other six employees who had been hired in the past month. After each person introduced himself, we let them know that, in honor of Moritz's presence, we decided that we wanted everyone to move together in unison to the music that was about to be played. If you've ever read anything in the media about Moritz, he's generally portrayed as an intelligent, introspective, and proper British journalist-turned-venture capitalist. So everyone in the room was excited to see that he was willing to stand in front of the room with the other new employees. Someone brought out a boombox and turned on the power as everyone started clapping and cheering. And then the music started playing. It was the Macarena. I don't think words can ever truly describe what watching Moritz being forced to do the Macarena was like. It ranks up there as one of the strangest sights to behold. Everyone in the entire room was cheering and laughing, and by the end of the song, I had tears streaming down my face from laughing so hard. I remember looking around the room at all the happy faces and thinking to myself, I can't believe this is real. It wasn't just about Moritz doing the Macarena, or that everyone in the entire room was laughing. It was about everything that happened in the past year. It just didn't seem real. In the words of Pretty Woman, I was living the fairy tale. Rapid growth. Shortly after we received funding from Sequoia, I reached out to Alfred, the guy I'd sold pizza to in college, to see if he would join us full time. He was busy working on getting his PhD in statistics from Stanford. To me, that sounded like the second most boring thing to do in the world. The most boring being watching paint dry at night when it's too dark to see what color the paint is. Over the previous 2 years, I'd been trying to figure out some sort of business we could do together. One of my earliest ideas was to open up a Subway sandwich franchise with Alfred somewhere on the Stanford campus. At the time, Subway was one of the fastest growing franchises in the United States, partly because the franchise fee and startup costs were so low. Alfred had actually considered doing it with me, but discovered that Stanford did not allow commercial activities on their campus at the time. When Sanjay and I first started Link Exchange, I had asked Alfred whether he wanted to join. He had thought it was too risky at the time, and was also worried that his parents would get mad at him for dropping out of grad school. So we agreed to stay in touch, and instead have him work as a consultant for us from time to time. This time, however, Alfred was a lot more receptive. I think it was due to the combination of knowing that we had $3 million in the bank from Sequoia, and him realizing that getting a PhD was not really his thing. He joined Link Exchange full-time in 1997 as our VP of Finance. Over the next 17 months, all of us slept very little. We were growing very quickly and hiring people as fast as we could. We had pretty much exhausted our network of friends for hiring employees, so we started hiring almost any warm body who was willing to work for us and hadn't done more than 6 months of jail time. We outgrew the floor we had rented out for our office and started expanding to additional floors of our building. We even opened up sales offices in New York and Chicago. It was a strange feeling to be walking around the office and seeing people I didn't recognize. It seemed like every week there was someone new. It wasn't just that I didn't know people's names or what their jobs were. I didn't even recognize their faces. Walking up and down the stairs of our building, I wasn't sure if the people I ran into worked for Link Exchange or one of the other companies that shared our office building. At the time, I didn't think it was necessarily a bad thing. If anything, not recognizing people due to our hypergrowth made things even more exciting and fueled the 24/7 adrenaline high that we were all feeling. But looking back, it should have been a huge warning sign for what was to come. The short story is that we simply didn't know we should have paid more attention to our company culture. During the first year, we'd hired our friends and people who wanted to be part of building something fun and exciting. Without realizing it, we had together created a company culture that we were all enjoying being a part of. Then, as we grew beyond 25 people, we made the mistake of hiring people who were joining the company for other reasons. The good news was that the people we hired were smart and motivated. The bad news was that many of them were motivated by the prospect of either making a lot of money or building their careers and resumes. They wanted to put a few years of hard work into Link Exchange and then move on to their next resume-building job at another company. Or, if things worked out well, make a lot of money and retire. We continued to grow and hire more and more people, and eventually we had over 100 employees in the company in 1998. One day, I woke up after hitting the snooze button on my alarm clock 6 times. I was about to hit it a 7th time when I suddenly realized something. The last time I had snoozed this many times was when I was dreading going to work at Oracle. It was happening again, except this time, I was dreading going to work at Link Exchange. This was a really weird realization for me. I was the co-founder of Link Exchange, and yet the company was no longer a place I wanted to be at. It wasn't always like this. Just a year and a half ago, I had made the "There Will Never Be Another 1997" speech to our employees. How did things change so quickly? What happened? How did we go from an all-for-one, one-for-all team environment to one that was now all about politics and positioning and rumors? Reflecting on the past year, I couldn't think of a single point in time when things started going downhill and it became less fun for me. There wasn't a specific employee I could point to who had single-handedly caused the company culture to deteriorate. It was more like death by 1,000 paper cuts or like the Chinese water torture. Drop by drop, day by day, any single drop or bad hire was bearable and not that big a deal, but in the aggregate, it was torture. I wasn't quite sure what to do. I pushed the thought out of my mind because there were some more immediate and urgent issues that we had to deal with. The economy wasn't doing well, something to do with Russian currency issues and long-term capital collapsing that I didn't quite understand, and the company didn't have much of a cash cushion to continue running if our revenues were to suddenly dry up. We had started doing work for an IPO so that we could raise some more cash, but the Russian currency fiasco erased the possibility of that happening anytime soon. We needed to raise a mezzanine round of funding as insurance, in case the economy got any worse. Otherwise, we could be bankrupt before the end of the year. Over the previous 2 years, we had built pretty good relationships with people from Yahoo, Netscape, and Microsoft. Each of those companies had shown a lot of interest in what we were doing, and was interested in figuring out strategic partnership opportunities. I never actually did figure out what a strategic partnership meant, or how it was different from just a regular partnership, but everyone who said it sounded smarter, so we liked to use that phrase a lot. To our surprise, all three of the companies said they were interested in possibly investing in our mezzanine round of financing. Even more surprising, Netscape and Microsoft both said that they were even more interested in buying the entire company outright. We told them that the price tag was going to be at least $250 million. I'm not sure how we came up with that number, but it sounded good to me, and I guess it was a good sign that Netscape and Microsoft both said they wanted to continue talking. They ended up getting into a bidding war. In the end, Microsoft offered the biggest number, $265 million, but there were some strings attached to it. They wanted Sanjay, Ali, and me to stay with Link Exchange for at least another 12 months. If I stayed the entire time, then I would walk away with close to $40 million. If I didn't, then I would have to give up about 20% of that amount. Even though Link Exchange was no longer fun for me, I figured that I could stick around for another year at that rate. I just had to do the bare minimum amount of work so that I wouldn't get fired. This practice of sticking around but not really doing anything was actually pretty common practice in Silicon Valley in acquisition scenarios. In fact, there's even a phrase that entrepreneurs use for this. Vest in peace. The deal was signed a few weeks after our negotiations with Microsoft began. Compared with other acquisitions that Microsoft had done, the Link Exchange acquisition was done in record time, despite some behind-the-scenes drama internally. Without getting into too much detail and to protect the guilty, it was an education to me in human behavior and character. Large amounts of money have a strange way of getting people's true colors to come out. I observed the greed of certain people who had joined the company right before the acquisition, trying to negotiate side contracts for themselves at the risk and expense of everyone else in the company. There was a lot of drama as people started fighting and trying to maximize the financial outcome only for themselves. For myself personally, I decided to step away from the drama. It only confirmed in my mind that selling the company was the right thing to do, as I certainly did not want to be working with many of these people ever again. I just had to stick it through another 12 months. One day, in early November 1998, Sanjay and I went to lunch together at a restaurant a few blocks away from the Link Exchange office. The acquisition had already been covered by the press a couple of weeks earlier, but the deal had not yet officially closed. As we were finishing up our meal, Alfred called me on my cell phone and told me that it was now official. The deal had closed. I looked at Sanjay and gave him the news. "Well, I guess the deal closed," I said. Both of us felt the same way. We weren't excited. We weren't cheering. We knew the outside world probably thought we were jumping up and down and doing cartwheels, but instead our mood was a strange mix of apathy and relief. The excitement of Link Exchange had disappeared long ago. Now we just had the drudgery of sticking around, uninspired and unmotivated, for another 12 months. "I guess we should probably walk back to the office then," I said. "Okay." And so we did, in silence. Cruise control. A bet is a bet. If I lose a bet, I always pay up. On graduation day in college, my friends made a bet with me. They bet that I would become a millionaire within 10 years, and if it happened, then we would all go on a cruise together, and I would pay for everyone's trip. If it didn't happen, then we would still go on a cruise together, but they would pull together and pay for my trip. To me, it seemed like a win-win situation. Either I would be a millionaire, or I would get a free cruise. Either way, I would be happy, so I agreed to the bet. It was early 1999, and we all flew to Florida to take a 3-day cruise to the Bahamas. I decided to invite some of my other friends as well, so we ended up with a group of about 15 people. I had never been on a cruise before, so I was pretty amazed at how big the ship was. There was a nightclub, 10 bars, swimming pools, and 5 all-you-can-eat restaurants. We had a great time drinking, eating, partying, and then drinking, eating, and partying some more. It was like a mini college reunion without all the boring parts. We all decided to go to the nightclub on the final night of the cruise to drink and dance the night away. In the eyes of all my friends on the cruise, I was everything that they thought defined success and happiness. My friends commented that I seemed more self-confident and congratulated me on selling the company to Microsoft. At 1 a.m., the DJ announced that it was last call, and the bar and club would be shutting down soon. As everyone headed to the bar to get one last drink before the night was over, I stood by myself for a moment to avoid the rush and to take in the moment. If someone had told me 4 years ago that I would be a millionaire and on a cruise ship celebrating, I would not have believed it. Yet, as the drinks flowed, the music pulsated, and friends cheered and toasted one another, a nagging voice in the back of my mind repeatedly brought up the same question that had been there ever since the silent walk with Sanjay back to the office the day the Microsoft deal closed. Now what? What's next? And then there were the follow-up questions. What is success? What is happiness? What am I working towards? I still didn't have the answers, so I went to the bar, ordered a shot of vodka, and clinked glasses with Sanjay. Figuring out the answers could wait until later. After the cruise, I felt like I was on autopilot. Waking up late, making an appearance at the office for a few hours and checking my email, then heading home early. Every once in a while, I'd skip going to the office altogether. I had a lot of free time and I didn't know what to do with it, so I had a lot of time to think. I'd already bought all the things I wanted, a place to live, a big screen TV, a computer, and a home theater system. I started going to Vegas every other weekend to play poker. I wasn't playing for the money. It was the challenge of figuring out how to beat the game. Poker is the only casino game where you're playing against other players instead of the house, so as long as you're better than the average player at your table, you actually can win in the long run. But most of my free time was spent just being introspective and thinking. I didn't need more money, so what was it good for? I wasn't spending the money I already had, so why was I staying at Microsoft, vesting in peace, trying to get more of it? I made a list of the happiest periods in my life, and I realized that none of them involved money. I realized that building stuff and being creative and inventive made me happy. Connecting with a friend and talking through the entire night until the sun rose made me happy. Trick-or-treating in middle school with a group of my closest friends made me happy. Eating a baked potato after swim meet made me happy. Pickles made me happy. Although for that one, I'm still unclear why. I think it's just because they are obviously delicious and I enjoy saying pickles. I thought about how easily we are all brainwashed by our society and culture to stop thinking and just assume by default that more money equals more success and more happiness, when ultimately, happiness is really just about enjoying life. I thought about how I enjoyed creating, building, and doing stuff that I was passionate about, and there was so much opportunity to create and build stuff, especially with the internet still exploding, and not enough time to pursue every idea out there. And yet, here I was, wasting my time, wasting my life, so that I could make more money even though I had all the money I ever needed for the rest of my life. A lot was going to change about the world. We were on the eve of not only a new century, but a new millennium. The world was about to change in a dramatic way, and I was about to miss out on it so that I could make even more money when I already had all the money I would ever need. And then I stopped thinking to myself and started talking to myself. There will never be another 1999. What are you going to do about it? I already knew the answer. In that moment, I had chosen to be true to myself and walk away from all the money that was keeping me at Microsoft. A few days later, I went to the office, sent my goodbye email to the company, and walked out the door. I didn't know exactly what I was going to do, but I knew what I wasn't going to do. I wasn't going to sit around letting my life and the world pass me by. People thought I was crazy for giving up all that money. And yes, making that decision was scary, but in a good way. I didn't realize it at the time, but it was a turning point for me in my life. I had decided to stop chasing the money and start chasing the passion. I was ready for the next chapter in my life. Chapter 3. Diversify. New ventures. Now what? Many of us left Link Exchange at around the same time, and we were all trying to answer the same question. We just made a lot of money from the sale of the company to Microsoft, and we were supposed to be basking in the fruits of our labor. But many of us didn't have any great answers. I thought back to my childhood fantasies. I'd wanted to work for the CIA in a James Bond type of role, become a robot inventor, and find a place to live with a movie theater and Taco Bell downstairs. I no longer wanted to be a spy or robot inventor, but living above a movie theater still appealed to me. As luck would have it, I happened to be driving around one day and saw that AMC was opening up a big new movie theater complex right in the heart of San Francisco at 1000 Van Ness. There would be 14 different movie theaters, and right above the lobby of the theaters, 53 brand new lofts were about to go on sale. When I learned that there was a Taco Bell less than 2 blocks away, I knew it was a sign. This was going to be my future home. I learned that real estate developers had actually taken over an entire city block and combined two buildings to create this space. In addition to the lofts and movie theaters, there was also a gym, an area designated for a future restaurant, and some commercial space that hadn't been leased out yet. I told other ex-Link Exchangers about the space. I thought back to my college years when there was a core group of us who always hung out together. We could create our own adult version of a college dorm and build our own community. It was an opportunity for us to create our own world. It was perfect. One by one, our crew started moving into the lofts. Alfred ended up living 2 doors down from me. By the time all of us had moved in, we collectively owned 20% of the lofts in the building and controlled 40% of the board seats of the homeowners association. It was like we were playing our own private real-life version of Monopoly. And nothing could compare to the spontaneity and convenience of being able to stroll over in pajamas to a friend's place or to the movie theater. While we were in the process of moving into our new homes, Alfred and I decided to start an investment fund. A friend of ours had a pet frog in college, and she dared us to name the fund and incubator Venture Frogs. So, of course, we did. We ended up raising $27 million from ex-Link Exchange employees and started meeting with a lot of different companies. We decided to turn one of the one-bedroom lofts into our office and set up a couple of computers and phones there. One day, I received a voicemail from a guy named Nick Swinburne, who said he had just started a website called ShoeSite.com. His idea was to build the Amazon of shoes and create the world's largest shoe store online. To me, it sounded like the poster child of bad internet ideas. Other companies were selling pet food and furniture online and losing large sums of money in the process. In my mind, it seemed like there was no way people would be willing to buy shoes online without trying them on first. I reached over to the phone, and just as I was about to delete the voicemail, Nick threw out a few statistics. Footwear was a $40 billion industry in the United States, and 5% of that was already being done by paper mail-order catalogs. It was also the fastest-growing segment of the industry. I did some quick math and realized that 5% was equal to $2 billion. It didn't matter whether I was willing to buy shoes without trying them on first. What mattered was that consumers were already doing it, and it seemed pretty reasonable to assume that web sales would one day be at least as big as catalog sales. Alfred and I decided it was at least worth a meeting. We had an informal meeting with Nick in our loft. He was dressed casually, wearing board shorts and a t-shirt. He looked like he could have still been in college, just stopping by to chat with us during his lunch break. We didn't pretend to have a real office, and Nick didn't pretend he had much more than an idea, but it was clear he was passionate about the opportunity. Nick told us he had just graduated from college a few years earlier. Nick summarized his entire pitch in three sentences. Footwear is a $40 billion industry in the U.S., of which catalog sales make up $2 billion. It is likely that e-commerce will continue to grow, and it is likely that people will continue to wear shoes in the foreseeable future. Do you have any experience in the footwear industry? Alfred asked. No, but I walked around a shoe show in Las Vegas a few months ago, and some of the people said they thought it was an interesting idea. Maybe you should find someone with footwear experience, I said. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea, Nick replied. We decided to stay in touch and agreed to set up another meeting once Nick had found someone to join the company who had experience in the footwear industry. I also suggested that Nick come up with another name. Calling the website Shoe Site seemed too generic, and it limited the business from eventually expanding into other product categories.
How I Got the Original Idea, by Nick. Buying a pair of shoes shouldn't be so hard, I remember thinking. Store after store, mall after mall, I couldn't find the pair I was looking for. It wasn't as if I was living in small-town USA either. If I couldn't find shoes worth buying in the Bay Area, I could only imagine the kind of trouble people had elsewhere. At the time, there were just a bunch of mom-and-pop stores on the web that didn't make shoe shopping any easier. So I thought, why not create a single place online that people could come to, find exactly the shoe they want, in exactly the right size, and have it show up on their doorstep in a few days? It was such a simple idea. Why wasn't anyone doing it? It was brilliant, until I discovered the reason. It wasn't going to be easy. The shoe industry was extremely fragmented and not very tech-savvy. But if I could figure out a way to create a network among all the separate shoe stores, that could be the solution. I went ahead and reserved the domain name shoesite.com. With the site ready to go, I just needed one other thing. Shoes. I headed down to the local shoe store, took pictures of their shoes, and put them on the website. Every time someone bought something on the site, I'd buy it from the store and ship it to them. For a big believer in technology, I couldn't have found a more primitive way to do it. But it worked. People started buying shoes. I didn't have the faintest clue about the workings of the shoe industry, but I knew I was onto something. Even though I'd never bought a pair of shoes through mail order, statistics proved there were a ton of people doing it. I stopped thinking, hey, this is a good idea, and started believing in it. Somehow, I had to make it work.
A few weeks later, Nick contacted us and said he wanted to set up a lunch meeting. He found someone named Fred, who worked in the men's shoe department at Nordstrom, and was interested in joining the company, but only if the company got funding beyond the small friends and family round that Nick had already raised. Nick also asked me what I thought of Zappos, spelled Z-A-P-O-S, as the name of the company, derived from zapatos, which was the Spanish word for shoes. I told him he should add another P so that people wouldn't mispronounce it and accidentally say Zappos. And thus, the name Zappos was born. A few days later, Alfred and I met with Nick and Fred at Mel's, a 1950s-themed diner a block away from where we lived. As we talked about the potential of Zappos, I did my best to not let the fact that Fred was a spitting image of Nicolas Cage distract me from the business conversation. Fred was 33 years old, tall, and really did look like he could be Nicolas Cage's stunt double. I ordered the turkey melt with a side of chicken noodle soup to dip the sandwich in. Fred ordered a turkey burger. Exactly 10 years later, Fred and I would return to Mel's and order the same thing to celebrate our 10-year meetingversary together. Nick talked about the progress that the website had made over the past few weeks. They were already getting $2,000 worth of orders a week, and the numbers were growing. They weren't making any money because any time an order was placed, Nick would run to the local shoe store, buy the item, and then ship it out to the customer. Nick wanted to put up the website just to prove that people would actually be willing to buy shoes online. There were literally thousands of different brands in the footwear industry. The real business idea was to eventually form partnerships with hundreds of brands and have each of the brands provide Zappos with an inventory feed of what was in each of their warehouses. Zappos would take orders from customers on the internet, then transmit the order to the manufacturer of each brand, which would then ship directly to the Zappos customer. This was known as a dropship relationship, and although it already existed in many other industries, dropshipping had never been done before in the footwear industry. Nick and Fred were betting that they would be able to convince the brands at the next shoe show to start dropshipping, and then Zappos would not have to own any inventory or worry about running a warehouse. Fred told us he'd climbed the corporate ladder at Nordstrom's for 8 years, just bought a house, and just had his first kid. He knew that joining Zappos would be a big risk, but he was ready to take a leap of faith if Venture Frogs would provide the seed funding for the company. Alfred and I looked at each other. Nick and Fred were exactly the type of people we were looking to invest in. We didn't know if the shoe idea would work out or not, but they were clearly passionate and willing to place big bets. We decided that we would invest enough money so that Zappos could hire more employees and meet payroll through the end of the year. The idea was that if the company was progressing and doing well by the end of the year, then Zappos could raise a lot more money from a venture capital firm such as Sequoia. We felt confident that since Sequoia had made out with more than $50 million from their $3 million investment in Link Exchange, they would be willing to place another bet on a company that Alfred and I were involved in. A week after our seed investment, Fred quit his job at Nordstrom. He was officially a Zappos employee now. He and Nick headed to the shoe show in Las Vegas the very next day.
My First Shoe Show as a Zappos Employee by Fred. I went to Las Vegas for the WSA, World Shoe Association, shoe show the next day as a Zappos employee. I'm not quite sure what we were thinking, but we showed up without a PowerPoint presentation or any marketing collateral. We just had a sheet of paper and an idea. We talked to about 80 different brands over the next 4 days. Only three agreed to work with us. It wasn't a promising number, but it wasn't surprising either. We were pioneering a new concept of having brands dropship directly from their inventory to the customer. Talking to brands was actually educational because they asked legitimate questions like, how are you going to ship it? Who's your shipping carrier? How do you plan to handle returns? At least we now knew a lot of things about what we didn't know. We retreated to our hotel room for lunch and asked ourselves what we needed to do. So we started cold calling. We left messages with DHL, UPS, and FedEx. After some nail-biting and a lot of idea-throwing, we finally got a reply. UPS was the only one that called back, and it turned out that it was the only one we needed. They believed in us from the beginning, and they're still great partners with us now. Looking back, a lot of our growth happened that way. We just throw ideas against the wall to see if they'd stick, improvise, and make it happen.
Alfred and I weren't very involved with Zappos during the first few months after we made the investment. We were busy meeting with other companies that were looking for seed investments. Over the course of the next year, we made 27 different investments, and we would check in with each of the different companies, including Zappos, about once every 2 weeks to see how they were progressing. To me, it was a bit of a strange shift not being involved in the day-to-day details of the companies that we were now investors in. Once the investment had been made, we would occasionally offer advice to anyone who asked for it, but for the most part, the companies were busy running on their own. I was getting bored with the investment business, so I started looking for something else to fill my time. I wanted to find something that was both fun and challenging at the same time. And that's when I discovered poker. Poker. I'd played a little bit of poker in college. But, like many people, I always just considered it to be a fun form of gambling and had never bothered to actually study it. Back in 1999, poker was not yet a mainstream activity. Most people had never heard of the World Series of Poker, and TV networks like ESPN were not yet broadcasting poker tournaments to the masses. One night, while battling insomnia, I randomly came across a website that served as a community hub for people who played poker regularly. I was fascinated by the amount of analysis and information about playing that was freely available, and spent the entire night reading different articles about the mathematics of poker. Like many people, I had always thought that poker was mostly about luck, being able to bluff, and reading people. I learned that for limit hold'em poker, which was the most popular type of poker in casinos at the time, none of that really mattered much in the long run. For every hand and every round of betting, there was actually a mathematically correct way to play that took into account the pot odds, the ratios among the amount of the bet, the number of chips already in the pot, and the statistical chances of winning. With the exception of poker, almost all games in a typical casino are stacked against the player, and in the long run, the casino always comes out ahead. I was intrigued by poker because in poker, you are playing against other players, not against the casino. Instead, the casino just takes a service fee for each hand dealt, usually from the winner of each hand. In a casino, each poker table seats up to 10 players. As long as at least one of the players is not playing in the mathematically optimal way, and usually it's several players that aren't, the players who are playing correctly will generally end up winning in the long run. Learning the basic math behind limit hold'em poker was not actually that hard. I bought and studied a book called Hold'em Poker, and started going to card rooms in California several times a week to practice what I was learning from the book. Although California is generally a no-gambling state, card rooms are allowed because poker is not a game against the house. Within a few weeks, I felt that I had mastered the basics of the mathematics behind playing hold'em. Understanding the mathematics behind hold'em and playing against players who didn't was like owning a coin that would land on heads one-third of the time and tails the other two-thirds of the time, and always being allowed to bet on tails. On any individual coin flip, I might lose, but if I bet on tails 1,000 times, then I was more than 99.99% guaranteed to win in the long run. Likewise, when playing a game against the house such as roulette or blackjack, it would be like being forced to always bet on heads. Even though you might win any individual coin flip, if you did it 1,000 times, you would be more than 99.99% guaranteed to lose in the long run. One of the most interesting things about playing poker was learning the discipline of not confusing the right decision with the individual outcome of any single hand, and that's what a lot of poker players do. If they win a hand, they assume they made the right bet, and if they lose a hand, they often assume they made the wrong bet. With the coin that lands on heads 1/3 of the time, this would be like seeing the coin land on heads once, the individual outcome, and changing your behavior so you bet on heads, when the mathematically correct thing to do is to always bet on tails no matter what happened on the previous coin flip. The right decision. For the first few months, I found poker both fun and challenging because I was constantly learning, both through reading different books and through the actual experiences of playing in the field. I started to notice similarities between what was good poker strategy and what made for good business strategy, especially when thinking about the separation between short-term thinking, such as focusing on whether I won or lost an individual hand, and long-term thinking, such as making sure I had the right decision strategy. I noticed so many similarities between poker and business that I started to make a list of the lessons I learned from playing poker that could also be applied to business. Evaluating market opportunities. Table selection is the most important decision you can make. It's okay to switch tables if you discover it's too hard to win at your table. If there are too many competitors, some irrational or inexperienced, even if you're the best, it's a lot harder to win. Marketing and branding. Act weak when strong, act strong when weak. Know when to bluff. Your brand is important. Help shape the stories that people are telling about you. Financials. Always be prepared for the worst possible scenario. The guy who wins the most hands is not the guy who makes the most money in the long run. The guy who never loses a hand is not the guy who makes the most money in the long run. Go for positive expected value, not what's least risky. Make sure your bankroll is large enough for the game you're playing and the risks you're taking. Play only with what you can afford to lose. Remember, it's a long-term game. You will win or lose individual hands or sessions, but it's what happens in the long term that matters.